What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
All right, here's an update on our Christmas tree decorating project, or actually Kat's, because my involvement really just includes sitting in a chair saying you missed a spot.
Also picking out the largest tree that's ever existed. Mm-hmm. So you choose the tree and then that's where it ends.
That's where it ends. Yeah. Well, I help bring it in the house.
That's not true. No. Mm. And then throughout the decorating process, which usually for me takes about 4 days, you will randomly stop and hold your hand over your heart and tell me that it's the prettiest tree you've ever seen.
That's true.
And that's really the only thing I need you to do. Okay. Is just continually compliment me.
That's all it takes to motivate you. We are experiencing quite a deluge of pine needles, though, because of the size of the tree.
It is a problem.
And they're everywhere.
Everywhere.
I pulled back the covers on the bed to get into the bed and just made the bed the night before. Fresh sheets. Pine needles everywhere in the bed.
Yeah.
I think the dog's responsible.
Absolutely. They get between their pads on their feet. They can't control it.
There are pine needles in the shower.
Yeah, well, naturally, because I am covered in them. And so I have to shower them off.
And last night, Kat discovered pine needles in her bra.
Yeah. It's very unpleasant.
And not just a few pine needles, like a shrub. Like she had a shrub.
It was a few.
In her bra.
And
it was a bra shrub.
Shrubbery.
If you will.
Yeah. So, fingers crossed, I will be done decorating by tomorrow.
So today I'm going to talk a little bit about Edgar Cayce.
Oh.
The sleeping prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a guy. This guy, yeah, he was lazy. He was a lazy prophet. quite a remarkable guy, actually. Interesting article on him in Ripley's Believe It or Not that talks about some of his, leading up to him becoming the sleeping prophet. Some of the things that happened to him were pretty unusual. Like when he was a kid, he used to play with, quote, the little folk and communicated with the dead.
I don't know what that means. The little folk, like fairies?
Yeah. Claiming that he could look right through them if he focused hard enough. In 1889, Cayce was 12 years old, and he was out in the backyard, just hanging out, looking for fairies, I guess. I'm not sure.
That's what I do.
And he claimed that he encountered a visit from a winged woman who promised to answer all of his prayers. Just kind of showed up in the backyard while he was communing with the little folk. When he met the lady, in fact, the day after he met the lady with wings, he got the results of his spelling test back from work, mm-hmm. From school. And it was really very poor. And his father had helped him study for this. And because he failed it so miserably, his father really took it out on Cayce. So Cayce recalled hearing at this moment while his dad was yelling at him, the winged lady's voice. And she told him that all he had to do essentially was when he went to bed was to put his spelling book underneath of his pillow. And when he was asleep, he would absorb all the information.
Oh, spelling through osmosis.
So he pleaded with his dad to be able to take a quick nap. He then placed his head on the spelling book, took a quick snooze. When his father woke him up, he had full recollection of the entire volume inside of his head. His father was stunned to find out that his son knew every page of the book. He had every page memorized. Of course, he went and retook the test and did extremely well. Now, he repeated this process. He did this throughout school. He would put his school books under his pillow, and by 1892, his teacher pronounced him the best student in the class.
Oh, wow. Gosh, I wish it was that easy.
Don't you?
Especially with spelling, because you and I,
God.
I
We're the worst.
The nature of the world says you should have married someone who could spell well, and I should have married someone who could spell well, mm-hmm. but neither of us can.
Neither.
It is a problem.
Neither of us can, and neither of us can spell neither. So his teacher said, hey, what's going on? You were like a poor student for so long, and now you're acing
hey,
all
you
of...
you used to suck. Why are you good now?
Why? What is going on? And he mentioned that he sleeps on his books. And each time he did this, he woke up to full recollection of the content. This is what he claimed. He was at a ball game at school, and he got hit in the spine with a ball.
Oh, no. Simon Birch style?
Kind of, yeah. Oh, Simon Birch. I haven't seen that in a long time.
I've never seen it.
Spoiler alert, it ends very sadly. Anyway, after he got hit, Casey started acting strangely. His parents put him to bed, and when he fell asleep, they were shocked because he started talking in his sleep. And he wasn't just babbling on, talking about nonsensical things. He was diagnosing his condition and described how to cure it.
I just think it's a really bad idea when your kid gets hit in the head with a baseball to then put him to bed.
It was the spine, actually. He got hit in the spine. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's a good point. You need to be careful, those post-impact naps. So he falls asleep and he's giving all, you know, he's diagnosing his injury and how to treat it while he's asleep. And his parents followed the instructions, and Casey was immediately healed.
I don't know. Where's this documented?
I believe it was written about by his son, Hugh Lynn Casey, in a number of books that he wrote. There are newspaper articles that are talking about this, or did talk about it, and they billed Casey as the illiterate man who became a doctor when hypnotized, which is not really what happened, but it sounded cool. They described Casey as a psychic diagnostician, and it wasn't just for himself. People would come to him with various medical ailments, and he would go in, lay down, take a nap, and diagnose it and prescribe a remedy for it with a remarkable, actually a stunning rate of success. Now, some of it, you know, pretty simple things like, oh, you've got a cold, drink plenty of fluids,
you know,
get some rest, that sort of thing. But he gave more than 14,000 readings covering a wide range of topics during his life. According to his biographer, Thomas Sugrue, quote, there are hundreds of people throughout the United States who will testify at the drop of a hat to the accuracy of the diagnoses and the efficacy of his suggestions of treatment.
14,000?
Yes, decades worth.
That's, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's anything I've done that many times.
I think we would all be hard-pressed to find something. And he only did, he tried to keep his readings, is what he called them, to one a day, because he was told by this greater consciousness that if he did more than one a day, he would explode.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, that's when we had the neighbor kids down the street that I used to prank a lot. I told them that I could fly, but I could only fly once a day. And so every time we hung out and they were like, show us how you could fly, I would be like, oh, I already did it today. Sorry.
Yeah, only once.
Yeah, otherwise I'll explode.
But in later life, because he had so many people clamoring for his services, he actually started to do more than one a day. And then he died.
Oh, he did explode.
Yeah.
I see.
Well, not technically explode.
Yeah,
not physically.
And not right away.
Yeah.
Much when he was much older.
Much older.
Interesting how that's happened.
Casey's health recommendations from the 20s and 30s do hold up to today's standards. Now, again, remember, there are things that we just take for granted, but back in the 20s wasn't quite as well known. His tips for leading a long and healthy life included getting a good night's sleep, cooking with olive oil, exercising and drinking plenty of water.
I love all those things.
All those things are legitimate.
Especially the olive oil.
And today we go, well, yeah, everybody knows that. But in the 20s,
It's kind of like when we were watching that Lewis and Clark documentary and they were like, Sacagawea wasn't feeling well. So after they took a bunch of blood out of her and she still wasn't feeling well, they gave her some mercury. And it's like, did you not want her to get better?
Casey also made some pretty fascinating prophecies. Now, some appear to have become fulfilled.
Sure.
Some not so much. Let's talk about the ones that they claim actually came true.
How is it that we've gotten to like episode 280-something and you've not talked about Edgar Casey?
I don't know. I think because everybody talks about Edgar Casey.
Sure. I think maybe you and I both have a kind of skewed version in our brains of what everyone talks about, because I said something like that the other day to a friend of mine. I was like, because everyone knows who blah, blah, blah is. And she was like, no. No, it's you have weird interests. And I was like, oh, that's right. That's why I do this thing. I'm sorry. I forgot. I forgot that. Okay.
It happens. So these are some of the prophecies that people claim have actually been fulfilled. In 1935, he predicted how World War II would unfold, describing an unprecedented alliance between the Germans, Austrians, and the Japanese. Now, think about that. In 1935, most people would go, that's impossible that those three countries would unite and become like an axis of evil. But that's what happened. It's worth noting that this alliance would not come to light until the signing of a pact on September 27th, 1940. Casey also predicted, quote, the whole world will be set on fire by these militaristic groups.
Wow.
He also claimed, this one is one of the most fascinating ones to me. He claimed in the 1920s that the use of blood would be used as a diagnostic tool.
But didn't they already believe that what was going on with your blood, like if your blood was haunted, then you'd be sick? Didn't they already think that? Oh, yeah, she's got the bad blood. She's got hot blood. Got to take some of that hot blood out of her.
He said, quote, for as seen, there is no condition existent in a body that the reflection of the same cannot be traced in the blood supply. For not only does the blood stream carry the rebuilding forces to the body, but it also takes the used forces and eliminates them through the proper channels in various portions of the system. Mm-hmm. And he went on to say that there will come a day that in the bloodstream, there will be reflections of evidences of the condition being carried by the physical body. That day may yet arrive when one may take a drop of blood and diagnose the condition of the physical body. Mm. So in 1927, when he made this prediction, that was not something they could do to the extent of what he's talking about now. And then you get into the whole DNA thing, which could be lumped in with that as well. You get DNA from a drop of blood. Mm. You can predict certain diseases that a person might be susceptible to. So
absolutely.
That's pretty fascinating. He predicted the stock market crash of 1929, 6 months before it happened. He said, we may expect a considerable break and bear market, this issue being between those of the reserves of nations and of individuals, and will cause, unless another of more stable banking conditions can come to relief, a great disturbance in the financial circles. This warning has been given. This was in March of 1929. In October of 1929, the great crash happened.
Yeah. The end of that prophecy there sounds a little more like a threat to me.
Actually, the entire closing statement was, this warning has been given, see? So immediately I'm thinking Edward G. Robinson from those old gangster movies in the 30s. This warning's been given, see?
You're going to lose all your money, see?
Your money.
Banks will close the doors, see?
Yeah, see?
Mr. Potter's going to try to make your loss his gain, see?
Yeah, see?
Yeah, see?
He also predicted, Casey, not Mr. Potter, Casey in 1929 predicted that communication companies would grow to a point that we would not recognize them, and that ultimately they would converge and consolidate and become centralized. He said, not that wars alone are to produce same, but the rumors of many of the same, making the necessity of communications in the varied fields to come under one supervision, will make physical coalition. As to when, In time, it may be years, but all of the varied channels of communication will work one with another and thus be varied commodities in their various divisions.
Obviously referencing Bill Clinton's 1996 Telecommunications Act.
That could be. He also went on to say, it's an opportunity for investment, as for holdings, as for speculative interest, both those of the air and of physical contact, meaning telegraph, telephone, as well as radio and radio operative forces, including international, American, Western Union, Westinghouse, and radio. And he also suggests that all of these devices for communication will be consolidated into a smartphone. Well, he didn't say that, but that's what he meant, I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
Now, he did predict things that didn't come true or haven't come true yet.
And right. I'll give it's you a probably couple, what it is.
A couple of examples.
Just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. The greater portion of Europe will be changed in the twinkling of an eye. Japan will eventually go into the sea.
Oh.
That, of course, has not happened. Although there are a lot of earthquakes in Japan.
Thank you.
So it's only a matter of time.
Okay. That's encouraging.
He said that there would be a shifting of the poles.
Okay.
And that this would begin in the late 1990s. Now, obviously the poles haven't shifted, but there was recently a show on Nova that said that in the southern hemisphere, they're starting to see fluctuations in the magnetic field there that could indicate a polar shift at some point. And it is a fact that the poles have reversed many times over the millennia.
Yeah, but in the 20s, they didn't know about that, right?
I don't know if they knew about that then. Now, he said the city of Atlantis would be found near Bimini in the late 60s. This is questionable. The city has not risen from the ocean, like a lot of people thought he was implying. However, they did discover in the late 60s what's called the Bimini Road. And it looks as though it was intelligently designed, like this top of a wall or a road that was constructed that disappears into the deeper ocean. Now, there are those who say it's a natural formation. Mm-hmm. There are those who say that it's impossible that that would naturally occur. And if you Google Bimini Roads and look at the pictures, you make your own decision there.
Bimini Road. Whoa.
Now, he also said that when that happened, that we would discover a killer laser made out of crystals in Atlantis.
On the shark's heads?
Frickin' sharks. And that hasn't happened that I know of, unless somebody found it and they're just keeping it to themselves.
Right, Bond style.
Right. But there's a lot that has happened, that did happen during Edgar Casey's life that was certainly unusual. And yes, a lot of it can be, I don't know, scientifically disproven, but a lot of it can be proven. Things pretty specific. I would say, you know, like the stock market crash. Yeah, it could be a lucky guess, but that was pretty specific. And at the time, things were roaring economically.
I think that would lead you one to believe that eventually the bubble will burst.
Well, you can say that, and certainly there are economists that would be able to. But Edgar Casey was, he was not a highly educated man. He was the illiterate prophet,
but you can be incredibly intelligent and not highly educated. Like, that's not...
That's true.
Those two things don't have to go hand in hand.
That is absolutely true.
Especially if you're trying to keep your intelligence undercover so that you can then be a prophet.
I see. Okay. I'll leave you with one of my favorite sayings. It's a quote from Edgar Casey.
Okay.
And take this for what you will. He said, "Dreams are today's answers to tomorrow's questions."
What?
And now, that thing in the middle. Frank Sinatra's son was kidnapped in 1963. The kidnapper said that all communications must be made through payphones. Sinatra was worried he wouldn't have enough money, so he ensured he was carrying a pile of dimes with him at all times. He did this for the rest of his life and was buried with 10 dimes in his pocket. 100% of our listeners surveyed say they listen to podcasts. That's a lot. This is The Box of Oddities. Support for The Box of Oddities is provided in part by listeners like you on Patreon.
You can support us too. Go to patreon.com/boxofoddities. Thank you.
The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
Hey, Megan sent us this email. I'm listening to today's episode at work, and I ran into the bathroom to hide and type this out. A listener described their phantom sixth and 12th toe, and that threw my memory back. I've always felt like I have two thumb-like toes on the inside of my feet like an ape would. Every time I've brought it up, I've been looked at like I was absolutely insane. But hearing this made me feel not so strange. Anyhoozle, thanks for everything you do, and thank you for getting me through my job. I always look forward to Monday and Thursdays. Man, thanks a lot, Megan.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. And it makes me wonder if it's some sort of evolutionary memory that we have
maybe
from early tree ancestor people type ape creature
our
things.
Our shrew friends?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But that's fascinating.
I love it. And I love that a couple of people have taken the opportunity to say, like, no, no, it's not just you. And that blows my mind. I love it so much.
That's what makes this freak community so amazing.
You know, when I was young, I thought that I should have a tail. But I think that's just because I had more animals around me than people.
Sure,
and
sure.
I was very easily confused. So
what you got for me?
Oh, all right. Kunigunda Matamotsky was born in 1873 in Brooklyn to a German mother and a Polish-Russian father. Now, as you can imagine, I'm never going to say that name again.
No.
She ended up calling herself Cora Turner. Thank goodness, because that's what I'm going to call her, too.
Okay.
Cora left home at 16 with aspirations to be a star. She was able to get acting and vocal lessons to advance her career, but they didn't seem to be panning out. And when she was 19 years old, she met Holly Harvey Crippen. Crippen had studied at the University of Michigan Homeopathic Medical School and graduated from Cleveland Medical College in 1884. His first wife had died of a stroke, and after that, he left his kid with his parents and moved to New York. In 1894, he and Cora met and ended up getting married. I don't know why I said they ended up getting married. I mean, it sounds like, oh, it just happened that they were married, but you know how.
I'm sure there was some planning that went
right
into it.
Right, it didn't like just, looks like we're married now.
We fell into marriage.
It just seems like looking back, it seems like a dumb way to have said that, and I apologize. Okay, so Cora's stage name was Belle Elmore. She was bold and outgoing by all accounts. She was a kind of an unlikely pairing for the mild-mannered Protestant Crippen. Crippen started working for Dr. Munyon's homeopathic pharmaceutical company, and in 1897, they moved to England. And although his medical qualifications from the States weren't enough to get him to be a doctor in the UK, he did end up working as a dispenser of meds in the UK. In 1899, Crippen was fired from Dr. Munyon's company for spending too much time managing his wife's stage career. Cora at this time was singing in a music hall and was the treasurer of the music hall Ladies Guild in London. So Dr. Crippen became the manager of Druitt's Institution for the Deaf, where he hired Ethel Leneve, a young typist, in 1900. In September 1905, Dr. Crippen and his wife took a lease on 39 Hilldrop Crescent in Holloway. It's rumored that part of the reason for this move was so that they could have separate bedrooms. The Crippens didn't do a lot together except for fight, and sometimes it was public. And it's unclear exactly when Crippen started having an affair with his assistant.
I knew it.
Leneve. But it's thought that it was right around the time that this move happened.
Sure. Yeah, well, separate bedrooms.
Right. Now, there were a couple of sources that had very different takes on how this whole situation went down. One was written in the style of, okay, so Cora was demanding and ill-tempered and sexless and also cheating on him and, you know, all these things. And it was just a very negative to Cora kind of vibe. And the other article was like, he immediately started fucking around. And, you know, so I think...
Wow. So pick your poison there.
I really think that probably it was somewhere in the middle, and it depends on who was telling the story, who was in the wrong. Mm-hmm. Either way, they were still married, and they decided that they would have a party for two close friends of Cora's, Paul and Clara Martinetti. So it's Monday, January 31st, 1910, and the meal was very nice, except for at one point Paul had asked to use the bathroom, and Crippen didn't bring him upstairs to show him where the bathroom was, and Cora thought that that was very uncouth of him and, like, gave him a dressing down in front of the guests. After the party, Cora's friends didn't hear from her for a few days. So as the days went by, a few had inquired where she was, and Crippen told one of Cora's friends that she had returned to the United States.
To visit her sister?
To visit relatives.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, as the days passed, he added, as people continued to inquire, that she had fallen ill.
Mm.
And then she ended up dying. And had been cremated in California.
Sure.
And she's not coming back.
This is not suspicious at all, Mr. Crippen.
No. It is very distressing, though, especially since right around this time, Ethel LaNeve had started wearing some of Cora's jewelry and clothes, and by the end of February had moved in with Crippen at Hilldrop Crescent.
Was she wearing the jewelry before the alleged death abroad?
It was all pretty intermingled.
Okay.
Some sources say that she was moved in with him before people even knew that Cora was missing. It was a real problem. So Cora's friend, the strong woman, Kate Williams, went to the police with her suspicions. They were kind of like, okay, we'll take that into consideration, ma'am, strong ma'am. But they began to take it more seriously when they were asked to investigate by a personal friend of Scotland Yard Superintendent Frank Frost, John Nash, and his entertainer wife, Lil Hawthorne.
Lil Hawthorne?
Lil Hawthorne.
Sounds like a rapper.
Well, I didn't get that vibe, but I do think that the name Lil Hawthorne is pretty much the best name I could imagine.
Okay.
I just love it. Mm-hmm. I want to have a baby that I can name. Like, I don't want to shoot it out of me, but I want someone to say that I can name their baby, and I will name it Lil. And then also Hawthorne. And they'll be like, well, which one? And I'm like, nope, both. And anyway. So July 8 comes around, and Chief Inspector Walter Dew went to the home on Hilldrop Crescent, and Crippen showed him around, and he told Dew that Cora had left him for another man.
All right.
Almost certainly, his name was Bruce Miller, and he was an American, and they met in 1903, and that she left him to be with Bruce in America.
So his story has changed.
It has. He explained that he had made up the story about her going to visit family / getting sick / dying / being cremated in California because he was embarrassed because she had left
him. Right, okay.
And this, according to the history press, Dew understood, but told Crippen that it would be better if he heard that story from Cora herself. So Crippen said that he would place an ad in newspapers where he thought she had gone, looking for her to reach out to the police so that, you know, they would know that she was safe. Cool? Totally cool. Except the next day, July 9, Crippen shaved off his mustache and with Ethel, disguised as a boy, went to Brussels. So there they bought tickets to Canada aboard the SS Montrose, traveling as father and son. Not suspicious at all.
That is really weird.
So police discovered that the pair had taken off and decided that it would be best to further investigate. During a search of the home in the cellar, police noticed some loose bricks in the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And after, shuffling things around a bit, they found the remains of a body. The body was headless, limbless, and boneless.
Oh, my God.
But it was determined that this was the body of Cora Turner.
He filleted her? Wow.
Meanwhile, Crippen and Lanive were crossing the Atlantic on the Montrose, and they had garnered some suspicion. They seemed to be unduly affectionate and were constantly holding hands.
As father and son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Added to that, the boys' clothing seemed to be very ill-fitting. Captain Henry George Kendall had the telegraphist send a wireless telegram, which was very new technology at this time. In fact, this case is credited as the first in which a capture was made based on wireless telegram technology.
Amazing.
The message said, "Have strong suspicions that Crippen London cellar murderer and accomplice are among saloon passengers. Mustache taken off, growing beard, accomplice dressed as boy, manner and build undoubtedly girl."
That's amazingly observant to put that together.
Yeah.
To think, yeah, that's the murder guy.
Must be. So Chief Inspector Walter Dew boarded a faster White Star liner from Liverpool, and arrived in Quebec ahead of Crippen and his son, and contacted Canadian authorities. They were arrested, and Crippen was put on trial at the Old Bailey before Lord Chief Justice Lord Alverston on October 18, 1910. The proceedings were to last 4 days. Crippen's defense maintained that Cora had fled to America with another man, and that Cora and Holly had been living at the house only since 1905, so that the body could have been there before they even moved in.
Uh-huh.
A pathologist, though, claimed that they found a piece of skin on the torso bits that he claimed showed a abdominal scar consistent with Cora's medical history. Also, the remains had been wrapped in a pajama jacket, and the tag inside the jacket led to the manufacturers, the Jones Brothers, and they confirmed that this particular piece of cloth and pattern was not issued until late 1908, which I think is some amazing police work.
That is.
So that shows that the body wouldn't have been placed there until after that date. Also keep in mind that medical tests had shown that the flesh contained traces of hyoscine, which is a poison. And that poison was purchased by Crippen 2 weeks before Cora had gone missing.
So this is not looking good for Crippen and son.
It's not. It's not. It's not. So the jury found Crippen guilty of murder after 27 minutes of deliberation.
Wow. That's just long enough for them to go back and pee.
Yeah.
And then come back and read their verdict.
Lanive was charged with being an accessory after the fact and was acquitted. Crippen was hanged at Pentonville Prison in London on Wednesday, the 23rd of November, 1910. He protested his innocence until the day he was hanged. No one really bought it, though. In 2007, The Guardian reported that working from a sample kept at the Museum of the Royal London Hospital Archives, a team of forensic scientists from the States compared mitochondrial DNA from the remains presented at the trial with samples that they got from Cora's surviving relatives. And the results were conclusive, according to Dr. David Foran, the head of forensic science at Michigan State. That body cannot be Cora Crippen.
What?
We are certain of that.
Did she Gone Girl his ass? Oh my God.
Unclear.
Whoa.
Unclear. Who the body belongs to, they don't know. They also think it's very suspicious that Crippen had purchased poison that could have been used for other things. I mean, it could have been like something used to drug but not kill, or keep someone from getting handsy. I mean, there are other reasons to have purchased the poison.
What if she like told him to pick a few things up on his way home from the store, and that happened to be one of them? And it was, you know, maybe something they used, like you said, maybe it was for, I don't know, some sort of a household cleaner. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's also rumored that on the side, Crippen had been performing illegal abortions.
Oh, my.
And that the body under the home may have been someone who died during one of those illegal abortions, which is very common during the days of illegal abortion. And he didn't want to fess up to that. Either way, we do know that the body in the basement was not that of Cora's, and that 10 years after the trial, a singer with a similar name was registered as living with Cora's sister in New York, and records show that the same woman entered the U.S. through Ellis Island from Bermuda in 1910, shortly after Mrs. Crippen disappeared.
Shut up. Oh, she gone-girled him. That is a great story.
And that is the story of the murder of Cora Turner / Cora Crippen / Belle Elmore / Cunigunda Makamotsky.
You said you weren't going to say it again, and yet you did.
Probably. I'm sure I didn't say it the same way. So
fascinating. Wow. So we're in the process of mapping out where we would like to go to do our next live tour sometime next year. And if you have a suggestion, if you'd like us to come to your city, send us an email, maybe reach out to your local comedy club.
Yeah, we're going to need some help figuring this out as we are treading these very weird waters over the next year.
And if you'd like to help support the Box of Oddities roll out this next tour, you can do so at our Patreon site, patreon.com/boxofoddities or theboxofoddities.com.
Also, if you want to send us something in the post, we are loving mail days recently. We've been overwhelmed with some amazing packages. We do have a new mail day video going up on YouTube shortly. 499 Broadway, Box 164, Bangor, Maine, 04401. Thank you so much.
And we'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. The Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories, stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. On Facebook at Facebook.com/Box of Oddities Podcast. On Twitter at Box of Oddities. And Instagram at Box of Oddities Podcast. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.